Hello and welcome to season 4 of Medical Women Talking. My name is Jane Dacre and I've been privileged to listen to the career stories of these inspiring colleagues. These women have all made an impact and many of them have overcome barriers in their careers. From them, you will learn that we all have setbacks and barriers in our careers, but what defines us is how we cope with this, which is part of life.
Natalie Jane McDonald. She's a non-executive chair and board member of a number of different healthcare organisations, and we're going to talk about her career journey. So, Natalie, it's lovely to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So your career has gone in a slightly unconventional way, if you compare it to mine, just sitting there rather boringly in the NHS and academia. So do you want to give me a quick summary of your career so far, and maybe we can talk about how it all worked out?
Thank you. Well, I think I'm not so unusual. I think that whilst there are lots of doctors who forge clinical research and academic mixture of careers, there's actually an awful lot of doctors who take one, sometimes two or even three steps sideways, and like me, never lose touch with what it was they were when they became a doctor, but take it in directions that are outside active clinical practice or research. And I've been surprised over the years how many women I've come across who have done similar things. But there are also real advantages, I think, speaking to other friends and colleagues who've remained within the NHS or academic medicine in that. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well, because I think you have to be careful in the choices you make and why you make them as you go through your career. So I studied medicine because I was really interested in people. I liked both sciences and sort of language related subjects at school, and medicine's significantly about communication, which has always interested me. And a sort of golden thread in my career is taking healthcare knowledge, medical understanding, and the fundamental aspects of that around evidence and so on, and focus on outcomes, into different things that are interacting with people, both professionals in healthcare, but also lay people and consumers and patients. And that's the sort of thread, I think, that goes right through my career. So I studied medicine, then I did house jobs, and then did my MRCP on a medical rotation in Glasgow. And then I moved sideways and became a clinical lecturer doing research on risk factor intervention in cardiovascular disease, so statins and so on. And then it was at that point that I started to think about how fulfilled I was in where I was, and that led me to taking my first step away from hands-on clinical practice.
So that's a really interesting juncture that you did your early training, and then you started to think maybe this isn't quite what I want or what I need in my career. So can you tell me a bit more about that? So you moved first of all into research academia, did you say?
Yeah, so I did clinical research and clinical trials and so on, and I did some work still on call and so on as a registrar at that time. In the teaching trust in Glasgow that I was working in. I think I discovered that whilst I was curious and interested in learning and the kind of evidence behind medicine, I wasn't what I might describe as a true academic or researcher. I could tell I didn't get the same buzz or affirmation from publishing, say, that I could see in colleagues whom I was working with in the University Department of Medicine. And I also, I think, one of the things I did was, because I was unsettled, and I went and I spoke to various heads of department of different clinical specialties, thinking maybe it's just that I'm not in the right bit of medicine in terms of clinical practice. And I think that I fell foul of the kind of counterside of what is often a very positive conversation, which is that so often it's a particular teacher or a particular lecturer or a particular boss who inspires us and takes our career in a different direction. And I met the different heads of department, and none of them inspired me. I don't know if they were a bit jaded or, you know, I was thinking, well, what would it might it be like to be you or in your department in 15 years? Yeah. What would that feel like? And I in none of them did I think, yeah, that's definitely the route that I want to go around. And so that then made me, I think, receptive then to what was a much less obvious sideways movement, which is that I saw an advert in the BMJ to be head of medical ethics for the British Medical Association. Uh-huh. And I'd done debating at school. I come from a family that likes a good argument about a meaty topic. And also I felt very strongly, you know, when I did my dissertation at university, I did it on anorexia nervosa and I was really interested in balance books about, you know, the patient and their illness and the relationship between the doctor and the patient. And, you know, the professional patient relationship versus, you know, a partnership with the doctor being informed, but it's the patient's body and the patient's mind and it's the patient who has the illness. And so I've been interested in that early on. So the opportunity then to work in an area like medical ethics and for, you know, of course, the BMA is a very significant trade union. But the other side of the organisation is all about professional practice. And the role of the profession, the role of doctors in society and in relation to patients. And at that time, the organisation was doing some really interesting work in areas like euthanasia, medical involvement, human rights abuses. And the person who headed up this whole area at the BMA was a really inspirational person called John Dawson, who died when he was 42, very early, from prostate cancer, and a real loss. And so I applied for this role.
So was it a full-time job? So it was,
yeah, it was a full-time job.
A move away from...
Yeah, so I was 20... quite brave. 28. I saw the job advertised. I thought, this looks really interesting. I applied for it and heard nothing for several weeks and thought, well, you know, nothing's going to happen. And then I got a letter. In the old days, I got a letter through the post inviting me to an interview in London at Tavistock Square. And I went down to that and it was, you know, a row of men, quite a lot of men in the room, and John Dawson was one of them. And he was very different. He was a bit of an iconoclast and a free thinker. And I could tell even in the interview what an interesting man he was. And luckily, I think probably down to him more than anybody else, I was fortunate to get the job. So within 6 weeks, I'd moved from Glasgow down to London and taken up my job in a very different world. Gosh. And that was my first step away.
How did that feel? Because I, even still now, I'm slightly scared of moving away from keeping up a bit of clinical practice. I sort of feel that that's part of my DNA.
A mixture of things. It was really interesting working with a diverse range of people on topics that I knew something about, but not a lot. So there was that sort of sense of learning again. There was definitely, I was quite perplexed by how seriously and how stressed people got about what essentially are bits of paper. And what I mean by that is, you know, having been a junior house officer in the old days, you know, before there was the working time directive and, you know, 1st of August, you're in A&E, you're on call and there's nobody around. And you have a very significant amount of responsibility and accountability. I was 22 in the June and I was in A&E in the August. So real accountability early on in your career. And so I was curious about then the world of business and organization where people were getting very stressed about things that to me had, you know, the consequences were not nearly as dire as the consequences of me as a junior doctor making a bad decision about what was wrong with the patient I was looking after or, you know, administering treatment in the middle of the night when there weren't other senior people around. So I think I had a, I think, although on the one hand it was scary going into a completely different world, on the other hand, that was offset by, I think, quite a healthy sense of proportion that I had from having been a doctor about, you know, in life what really matters, and that people getting, I think, often stressed about things that in the end are not as important as maybe they seem. And then I know what you mean about stepping away from clinical practice, but I think that's one of these things that sort of creeps up on you, that you don't notice it in the beginning because you're just not doing it. And then there are definitely points subsequently where I paused and thought, well, how do I feel that my next move is going to still also not be in clinical practice, or I'm stepping another step away from hands-on medicine, and it becomes harder to go back. But I just always found that the things that came up or the opportunities that emerged were so interesting in and of themselves that I didn't feel that I was losing something. I felt that I was taking my training and education as a doctor into areas where it was relevant and useful, but it was just being made use of in different ways.
I sometimes think as doctors that we focus perhaps a little bit too much on the individual patient in front of us, and those that have the interest or the ability, if you stand back and influence the system or a system like you would have done in ethics, actually you're probably helping more patients in the end.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, individual doctors make huge differences to individual patients. But I also think there's, you know, that I haven't gone into something like politics, but I have worked in areas where hopefully the decisions that I've been involved in making with others will have influence, positive influence, either on patient or on the people who care for those patients, in terms of the doctors and other healthcare professionals who are caring for them.
So how long did you stay doing that job, and where did you go next?
So I stayed there for 4 years, but I spent a year out. I was married. I've been married once before. I'm married second time now, and I had a year sabbatical in that time. I worked in Thailand for a year, in Bangkok. And
in medicine, in clinical practice, or
no? I worked for the. I did some voluntary work settings that were, looking after children, disabled children, but that was voluntary. And because I need to work, I'm very driven. I would have, having a lovely year in Thailand, I thought after about a month, I was climbing the walls in terms of not having enough to do or meaning, it's having purpose and substance. So I ended up working for the French Chamber of Commerce because I studied French at school and carried on with a bit of French, and I was wanted to keep up my French, and so I worked there. So it was very interesting. I was working with Thai people and French people and in Bangkok. So that was interesting. Wow. So I came back, went back to the BMA, and then I was approached to join Bupa, to be medical director effectively at the time when Bupa had hospitals, by somebody I knew who had gone to work there. And so that's what I did. I think I jump in. I think I'm quite intuitive. If it feels this might be interesting and an opportunity to learn, I'm very driven by learning and so on, then I jump in. And so I did, I jumped in. I definitely had some of the reaction, probably even stronger then than it is nowadays, of people saying, oh, you're going into the private sector and you're going to the dark side. And
yes, that, people do say that, don't they?
That sort of thing, which is, I think, a bit unhelpful really. And I don't think the world, works like that. I don't believe in public good, private bad, and so on. I think people make contributions in all sorts of different sectors. Mm. And so I moved. And actually, I found that my time at Bhopal was really good because I had the opportunity to work in lots of different areas, to understand how organizations work, to learn a lot more about governance, to learn a lot more about healthcare systems, the links between clinical practice and outcomes, how it is that you influence doctors and so on, you know, good ways to engage, how do you effect positive change, and those sorts of things. So really, really important things, I think, that I've taken into roles that I've done since. Yeah, and also important things in terms of, if we look at what happens in healthcare, you know, more generally, and we look at, you know, some of the challenges of taking really committed professional people who are in complex systems, and where we're trying to evolve those systems to be, you know, cost effective, to deliver great outcomes, to give people a sense of professional self-worth, but they're also efficient and productive and so on. You know, doing that and doing that well is very easy to say, but extremely hard to do.
Yeah, and so it's not something that's actually ignored rather too much, isn't it, in postgraduate training? Well, in my view, in postgraduate training that we all go through, which focuses very much on the content rather than the way it's delivered in relation to healthcare.
Yeah, and I think that it's too, and I don't think it's peculiar to medicine. I'm doing some work at the moment also with the veterinary world. And, you know, vets are still very much organized in small general practices, a bit like GPs, although they have a wider scope of practice. And the generalist is still, in terms of surgery and so on, much more present there. And when you speak to vets, they say the same thing. You know, they have very little preparation for the world that they're going to inhabit outside the hands-on clinic, you know, the system that they're part of, and how they play their part in that system. If they find themselves in positions of leadership, very few of them have had true education and learning around how to be effective, or how to be effective leader. How to be a leader, for example, you know, the old firm system in medicine where you have the apprenticeship model is one, but what happens when you're leading teams that are much more diverse, where you have non-clinically qualified people, you have people whose expectations are really different. And I think often in medicine, there's a sort of sense that people find themselves in often in very senior positions as medical leaders in all sorts of settings. And people do amazingly well, bearing in mind they've often had little proper formative education to enable them to take on those roles. They kind of learn by doing and by watching others, which of course is a really important way to learn. But yeah, I found that my time at Bhopal was good because I was able to watch a lot of people, you know, see good things, see bad things, become more rounded as a leader, more informed about healthcare systems as well, and then take that learning then into the roles.
So did you get training? Did you get specific training in leadership or was it experiential?
So it was both. So when I'd been at the BMA for 4 years, and I knew that I wasn't going to go back into, I decided I wasn't going to go back into clinical practice at that point. And I thought, well, if I'm going to be involved in broader organizations, then whilst I don't want to be a marketeer and I don't want to do corporate finance, I will be in organizations where there are people who do these things. So I did the GMAT and applied to business schools to do an MBA. And so coincident on me joining Bhopal, I got a place at London Business School. So I started work at Bhopal, and at the same time I was doing an executive MBA at London Business School.
Gosh, hard work.
Yeah, hard work, but really good. I mean, you do your assignments, you do it on the organization that you're in. So you're learning and doing and learning and doing. I wasn't, you know, I didn't have children or anything at that point. So it was easy to throw myself into everything that I was doing and, you know, which I did.
And were you there for a long time? How long did you work
I was
there?
In Bupa overall for 15 years, so I was there for a long time, a really formative part of my career. Also, you know, I had three children in the second half of that period. Bupa was a great employer of women. You know, had a woman chief executive, very senior women in senior roles, very understanding of the balance between. So it was a good organisation to be in terms of coming back to work and so on.
Fantastic. You just, for the purposes of the tape, you cut out a little bit there. So you talked about how you had a lot of women bosses and they were very understanding of the balance of,
and then
you disappeared.
Yeah, so I found Bupa to be a good employer, you know, to when I was becoming a parent, had women in significant roles and, you know, understood it that having children is a parental responsibility, not just a maternal responsibility. And, you know, were supportive. I mean, I went back to work pretty quickly after my children. It was good at that point, I think, to have that continuity whilst my children were little.
And
I was fortunate
enough
to work
full time. Sorry, did you work full time?
Yeah, I've always worked full time. I think I've got one piece of advice I always give to women. So I know lots of women who decide to go down to 4 days a week, and they'll have a Friday off or a Monday off or something. And my view is that organisations get 5 days work out of women who work 4 days a week because you just do. If you're going to, and actually a lot of women I know do it because they want to do some things for themselves and they feel more comfortable saying that they're working 4 days a week, but actually they still do their, I rarely see that 20% of their job is taken away. They do the 100% in 80% of the time, or they work out how it gets done. So I think that if you are going to go to part-time, you need to go to at least 3 days a week for it to have a meaningful difference on the amount of work that you actually do. But I've always worked full time all the way through.
I wish I'd have known you then, because I went to 4 days a week, and one of my colleagues, Tim Spector, who's now done very well in other areas, told me that I needed to become a full time Skyver rather than a part time martyr. Which is,
I think that's right.
What you're saying.
I think, well, that's a really neat way of describing it, but I think that's true. I think women have a tremendous sense of conscience and probity about their work. I mean, I see it in not just women in medicine, but in all my friends and other things, and we're very conscious of not shortchanging whoever and whatever we're doing, but often we shortchange ourselves as a consequence.
And so how did you get into doing your portfolio that you now have?
So I ended up at Bupa running the UK businesses. And then from there, I was chief executive of an organisation in children's services. So we ran schools for children with additional needs, you know, autism, behavioural difficulties and so on. And also residential care for children who couldn't be in their own family home. And I did that for 4 years, and then the business was sold. And I had taken on, in 2003, I think it was, I was asked by Bupa to sit on a board of an organisation I had an interest in. And I, as an appointed director, really, so not a true independent director. And I, at that point, I realised, well, I don't really know anything about boards. And so the Institute of Directors, the IOD, ran then and still run a programme where they do a diploma in company direction, and then you can become a chartered director. And I did that sort of part-time while working over a number of months. Then you sit an exam at the end of it. And really it's to inform you about, you know, corporate governance, the legal structures around companies and what it is to be a director, both the kind of hard elements of it and the softer ones. I found that really useful. So way back in the early 2000s, I was already doing sort of something on the side that was involved in being a director of an organisation. And then I then joined the board of Which, the Consumers Association. I had a friend who was involved in Which, And that was quite interesting, different sort of organization, obviously very strongly in terms of consumer rights. And, you know, I believe in consumer rights, patients' rights, that side of it. So it fitted with my psyche. And then in 2014, I became a non-executive director at the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital in Stanmore. So I sat on an NHS board when Tony Goldstone was the chair there. And that was very interesting at the time, where we're raising money to try and get out of the Nissen huts that they are in.
I remember those well.
Yeah, and into a more modern building. And so I was chief executive of one business, and then I was chief executive of another organisation that was at the other end of the spectrum. It was in elderly care. And I did that again for 4 years and through COVID. And then the business was going to be sold, and I'd already decided that I didn't want to do another CEO role at that point, because they're, you know, all organizations are different, but in the end they're all the same. It's all about building a team, having a team where the whole is more than some of the parts, and then delivering whatever change that it is that you're trying to do. And it's hard work to do that, and I'd done it three times, and I decided I didn't want to do it again. So at that point, because I'd already been a director and a non-executive director in a number of businesses, it was easy then at the end of 2021 then to, stepping away from a full-time executive role then, to take on a couple of other things that then sort of, so I chair two companies at the moment, two organisations, and I'm a non-executive director on two others. And I do some mentoring of younger and middle and senior managers who are coming through to help them develop their careers.
Sounds fantastic.
So I've had an unorthodox pathway compared to what I might have thought when I went into medicine all those years ago. But I've had, you know, really interesting time. I've done all sorts of different things and worked with a huge variety of different people. And I still, I wouldn't be safe. I'm no longer, you know, rightly, licensed to practice. But I'm still involved in things that are to do with healthcare. And I feel that, and people, and that's a sort of, as I said earlier, that's a kind of golden thread. I love working with people and creating change and so on. And I feel I'm really interested in how people tick and what makes them who they are, and therefore what makes them effective and successful. And I think at the, you know, the roots of, you know, the patient-doctor relationship, you know, it's about that, the doctor's the professional, but the, you know, the patients are similar, but they're all different. And so
you've described it in a very articulate way, as if it was all smooth, plain sailing, and it all went absolutely swimmingly. Yeah. Tell me about some barriers that you've had to overcome.
Well,
just one.
I think that as you get older, you often get more thoughtful, less impetuous, that weight of experience and so on. When I was a young doctor and in an organisation like the BMA, they were very male. They were very, it was men in all the positions of authority. The women were in the support roles. You know, as a junior doctor, you're asked, you know, those ridiculous questions about what your plans are for family and all this kind of stuff. And my mum, who's still alive, is 92, was a teacher and was a primary school head, and very driven and very professional, very good at what she did. And so from being a child, I always had a very strong female role model in her. And I think that then made me not see the barriers and the sexism and the, you know, being patronized and all the sorts of things that were very significant in medicine and, you know, are still are sometimes as a woman. So I think the biggest potential obstacle I had was being pigeonholed as a woman, a young woman, when I was making choices in healthcare, and me being sort of bloody minded and determined and not recognising that and thinking, you know, I'm as good as anybody, and, you know, gender is sort of irrelevant. It's, I mean, I suppose I recognise that a lot of people do. I believe in, you know, a lot in meritocracy. You know, people say when they're junior, I'm like, how do you get on? Have the right attitude, work hard, listen well, learn, and you'll get on. Of course, there comes a point where that doesn't apply anymore, and politics and lots of other things become much more significant. So I think the potential obstacle I had was being pigeonholed as a young woman in healthcare, and doors not being opened, and I just kind of pushed the doors anyway. I think the other obstacle I've had, and it maybe doesn't come over, you know, in what I'm saying, but it's that women still, and I, you know, that little voice in your shoulder, can I do that? Am I up to this? Mm. This is really scary. Negative self-talking, you know, not wanting to do something until you're really, really sure you can do it, as opposed to, well, I'm 40% sure, I think I can give it a go. I think has been the most significant thing. I mean, I'm quite introverted. I hate networking and all those sorts of things. So I've really had to force myself over my career to get good at some of those sorts of things that certainly don't come in intuitively to me. And my sense, talking to other women, and I, you know, some of my friends have been very successful in different things, is that often the biggest obstacle and barrier we have is ourselves and our limiting, our, you know, we limit our belief in ourselves and what we can do, and we close doors unintentionally that actually we could have walked through them and we'd have been really successful.
Yeah, very, very wise. Now, you've said in passing along the way that you have 3 children. So mm-hmm. You're clearly a very successful woman, very successful businesswoman. How has that all worked out? Has being a successful woman influenced your personal life?
I've got a very supportive husband. So I suppose I've had the, if you were talking as a couple, I've had the, certainly in the past 12 years, the kind of the main breadwinner. And so, you know, what I was saying earlier about having children is a parental responsibility, not a maternal responsibility. That's how we approached that. So we both played our part, and that enabled me to work full time and have a full career. I think that, I mean, I've got one child still in education. She's in her final year at university, and the other two are working, my other son and daughter, none of them in medicine. I think my daughters have, you know, our children probably work until they're in their 70s, and they'll have, you know, maybe multiple different careers, because that's much more of a trend now. But I think that partly because they're my children, more because the world fortunately has evolved, is I think all of them think that there's nothing that they can't do if they, you know, put their mind to it, and they've got an aptitude for it, and they certainly shouldn't be constrained in their choices because of where they've come from or their gender or anything like that. It's the most important thing I've done. I think one of the things I thought was very, very important, and I was very conscious of going back to work early and then working full time, is that by making that choice to have, you know, excellent childcare. We had the same nanny for 17 years. So, you know, we were very lucky, and we had, you know, wonderful nanny for 17 years who helped us bring up our children. But by choosing to go to work and not being with my children, I needed to do the best job I could, the most interesting work, and really get the most out of it, because that was the choice I was making. I wasn't somebody, you know, being in medicine and I wasn't working because I had to work. I was working because I wanted to work, and I felt it was really important. And therefore, I wanted to do something, you know, I wanted to make the best of it that I could be. So I think working mothers always seem to me, when they come back to work, whether full time or part time, to, you know, no nonsense, got on with the work, highly productive, really efficient, very well organized. I mean, juggling home and family and school lunches and school children's activities and everything that you have to do. You know, who do you want? You want a working mother.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's so great to hear, and I'm sure will be absolutely inspirational to people who are working mothers who are struggling to be that juggler on a monocycle to keep it all together.
Well, you don't feel that, you feel terrible at the time, and you have that guilt. Yeah, you feel guilty. You think, you know, you feel when you get really tired and exhausted, and you feel that you're a terrible mother, and then you don't think that you're good enough. You've got that little voice, you don't think you're good enough at work, and I've had all those feelings lots of times. But when I look back now with hindsight, I'm still glad I did what I did, and I feel that my children seem happy, which is the most important thing, and hopefully I have a good, I've got good relationships with them, and they understand. I think they understand how fulfilling work can be, that if you find something that you enjoy, it's not a chore. It really helps you become a fuller person. And that in so doing, you become a better person in all of your life.
So based on that, perhaps, if you were to give one piece of advice to the women that are listening to this podcast coming through, one piece of advice that will inspire them to be a successful woman in medicine and related areas, what would you say?
I would say it's don't believe your own little voice that questions whether that you can do things. And be driven by your heart, not your head. I mean, I grew up at a time where it was, and I remember speaking to my parents, and, you know, people got a job and they stayed in it for life. You know, it was, well, why would you want to change job? You've got a very good job. But we only have one life. And you have to live it to the full. And so I would say, don't be scared. If you're bored in what you're doing, or you're not fulfilled, or the light's gone off in here, or you don't think it's, you don't feel that, you know, when you stand back and you look at it, it's not, then do something about it, because you'll be fine.
Brilliant. That's such good advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Natalie Jane, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
A pleasure.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.